Welcome to Be Customer Led, where we'll explore how leading experts in customer and employee experience are navigating organizations through their own journey to be customer led and the actions and behaviors employees and businesses exhibit to get there. And now, your host, Bill Stakos.
I'm with my good friend, Karen Holt here. Karen wrote this amazing book, Experience Design, The Innovator's Journey. We're going to get into the details of the book, why she wrote it, the motivation, and just some different aspects. When I went through it, as someone who loves the practice of design thinking, has seen the power of design thinking in changing organizations, this book is probably one of the best books I've read on the topic, frankly. And there are incredibly useful tools inside the book as well to help people, whether they're new to design thinking or have been practicing it for years. Karen, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you on.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So I ask every guest, whether live or pre-recorded, I ask every guest to tell us their journey and tell us yours and, you know, what led you to writing the book? What was out there missing in the world for you? They were like, we need to do this. We need to put something like this out.
Yeah. So my journey is like two parallel paths. One is that I was part of the brand team on the Folgers coffee brand in the early 90s when Starbucks was just a regional business in the Pacific Northwest. It's hard to believe that that was the case, but it was about a $165 million business in the Pacific Northwest. And I was on the Folgers brand, which was close to a $1 billion brand. Mm. And the younger members of our brand team thought that there was something to this Starbucks experience that we should be paying attention to. And we couldn't get the attention of our senior executives because we were the big brand, right?
We were Folgers.
We were Folgers. But we did manage to send a bunch of executives out to Seattle. They went around to 25 different coffee shops, came home to Cincinnati, which is where our headquarters were, and decided to do nothing. And the reason is that we were a very data-driven company. Mm-hmm. We relied on Nielsen syndicated data, which measures club store sales, grocery store sales, mass merch, and convenience stores. And so in that data set, Starbucks didn't exist because their channels were other channels, right? And so we didn't respond. And, you know, fast forward 30 years, Starbucks is a $24 billion business and Folgers is a $2 billion business, right? They generate 12 times the economic impact that Folgers does. And, you know, I left after a year and my husband and I started our own company, but that experience has sat with me for a long time because I couldn't understand how we missed that opportunity. And what I realize now is that if we had an appetite for qualitative data, we might have done some experimentation and been able to find this opportunity and leverage it for our own benefit. But we really didn't value qualitative data as an opportunity to identify new solutions and also to solve our current problems. P&G is now. P&G has been,
sure,
right? They've been a real driver of using design and it's been very successful for the company. But at the time I was there, that wasn't the case.
So interesting to think about how much design has matured as a discipline and as a practice, the impact it's had on customer experience, like big customer experience, right? Big C, as well. Was there anything about the book as you were writing it or researching for it, whether it was personal growth, any surprises, you know, can you share a story about that? I'm always curious about the book writing process and authors and, you know, how they may even mature perhaps through the process.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that motivated me to write this book was really to help the users of design thinking figure out how to experience design more deeply. Because we found that in working with a lot of innovators, they had very different experiences, and I couldn't understand why some people had this profound experience and it literally changed their life and even resulted in career pivots or career changes. And there were more obstacles in the way for other people who experienced the same, you know, the same learning, the same hands-on practice, the same project. And I knew that because I do a lot of personal reflection when I work with innovators. And so I would read their journals and, you know, somebody would have on a scale of 1 to 10, somebody would have a 10 experience and somebody would have a 3 experience for the same week and the same activities and so forth. I couldn't understand what that was. And so we had the opportunity at Darden, because I wrote this book with my good friend, Jean Litka, who's a professor at Darden. We had the opportunity to work with students in her class and use the DISC profile as a way to understand different behaviors and different mindsets. And I was really surprised that what we were seeing as a sort of notional experience in working with innovators, but there was actually a very statistically significant pattern in the way that different DISC profiles reacted and responded to innovation. Mm-hmm. And so that was, it was a surprise, and it wasn't a surprise because that was my experience working with innovators, but to see that statistical significance was a pretty big surprise.
So so folks who are listening in now don't know this, but we were joking behind the show. And I love the fact that you're using DISC. At Freddie Mac, we use DISC. That platform has come a long way. Really great program and way to get to know your peers and colleagues. But the driver, as one of the profiles, maybe isn't as in tune with design thinking or sees the benefits right off the bat. I personally experienced this at a prior life where clearly a driver in the room before even going into the session was like, arms crossed. Why am I spending my time here? I've got the answer. We don't need to spend 2 days in a design thinking workshop, blah, blah, blah. Comes out the other end. Wow, that was actually really helpful. I was fascinated by the quick turnaround and complete turnaround, frankly, of that individual, given the work. I'm curious, just in your research, is the driver one of the folks that you do focus on? Because you have the profile in the book, you talk about things, and you actually have a comment from a driver in the book. And I laughed when I read it because I was like, oh my gosh, I think they said that exact thing. Like, do all drivers say the same thing, right? Like, it was just very funny.
I know. So drivers, gosh, I love drivers because they have a passion for getting things done, right? Yeah. Drivers are the people on a team who everyone relies on the team to get things done. But that creates an interesting tension when they have to suddenly sit and rest in ambiguity in order to better understand a problem before they solve it. Controlling that need for closure is really hard for a driver to do because they're rewarded professionally for getting things done. And their whole professional identity is around being a problem solver. So asking someone like a driver to sit in a problem and wait for other people who move at a much slower rate than they do is really scratchy and really uncomfortable. But what we hope is that by articulating that, pointing it out, we can let both individual innovators know this is the experience that you're going to have and it's okay. And also to let facilitators or people who are supporting innovators go through the process know this is to be expected. And here's what drivers need in that moment.
You know, you start off the book saying something that really struck a chord with me, and I'm going to read it here. You start off by saying that the transformational power of design thinking lies not in what it encourages us to do, but in who it encourages us to become. What did you mean by that? And like, who, more importantly, maybe even, who do you hope readers will become through design thinking, or maybe become through reading this book even?
We wanted to offer people a way to deepen their experience with design thinking because there are a set of activities that we all do. You know, we may call them different things, but there's a set of activities like immersing ourselves into data, generating insights, coming up with design criteria, brainstorming, prototyping, and then doing experimentation. But what we wanted to articulate was that behind the scenes, there are a set of mindset shifts and a set of behaviors that accompany those activities that, when done well, creates this shift in people's experiences so that they actually become someone new in the process. And it is that becoming that we think is critical to creating new designs and creating new solutions. Because unless you can set aside your own personal biases and step into the shoes of someone else and give them the benefit of the doubt of having a set of experiences that may be different from your own, it is impossible to create something new because we're wed to our own rightness.
That's really, oh man, I love that. So let's get a little bit more into the book based on that comment. So you lay out early 6 steps or phases in this journey of doing, experiencing, becoming. Help our listeners maybe understand that journey a little bit and maybe talk to a couple of the 6 steps that kind of make that up.
Yeah. So they're phases more than steps because they are the behind the scenes experiences that are happening that produce those profound changes in the innovators who use it. So for instance, in immersion, which is the first stage around gathering data, we're not talking about doing a couple ethnographic interviews because doing a couple ethnographic interviews done really superficially doesn't lead to an experience of immersion, right? Immersion really sets the stage for the user of design thinking to shift their perspective and to engage their emotion. And it helps them see and care about new possibilities that really sets the path for the rest of the cycle. Likewise, in sense making, we're gathering the data that allows people to transform lots of data points into new knowledge and build that emotional commitment that's really necessary for coming up with new ideas.
Very cool. You know, one of the things that I love, you have a play on minimal viable product or MVP in the book. You call it MVC or minimum viable competencies.
Yeah.
As part of this effort, right? Or process or mindset, so to speak. Or even as part of that transformation, right? So there are immersion, sense making, you just talked about alignment, emergence, imagining, and learning and action. Yeah. Why did you have to set these up early? Why didn't you maybe set them up later in the book? I was just curious, like, why up front did you say these are critical competencies and you bring in great examples of each one of them? Why so early in the book? And even in the, I mean, it's in the introduction chapter, essentially, the first couple of pages.
Yeah. You know, we talked about that a lot. Of course, we wrote chapter by chapter. So we wrote those chapters after we wrote the individual chapters. And we felt that as we were reading the book, we needed to provide some wayfinding for the experience that we were trying to set up. And we thought that we needed to introduce that at the beginning of the book so that the reader could understand the transformational journey that we were hoping to articulate for them that would happen and would unfold over time. And so we thought it was really important. By the way, that diagram was, that was really hard.
I'm sure. And you bring MVCs back later in the book, which is really important to bring, give more context as well. I want to get into that in a little bit as well, but the layout of the book is really interesting. You've got sort of, after the intro, you've got 4 kind of broad phases, chapters within that. This is my favorite part of the book. Actually, it is that different strokes for different folks. And that's where you kind of bring in DISC and the different personas. Yeah. It was really interesting for me just because I was able to really connect that with sort of my past experience, and you got into each persona. Why is it that important for design thinkers or teams leading design or employing this mindset more broadly as a company, why is it important to understand the different personas, particularly as you have them in the room and they're all working towards sort of a common goal or vision or outcome?
Yeah. So we thought it was really important to lay out the array of innovators that we're going to be in a room working on a project. And if you're not seeing these different innovator types, then maybe you don't have the diversity on the team that you need, because a lot of people who are attracted to the front end of design don't necessarily enjoy working with people who are really great on the back end of design, right? People who are really good at testing have a really hard time with the front end of design. But if you only invite people to problem solving or to innovation that are really good at the front end, then your idea might sit on the shelf and never get implemented because you don't have the people who are really good at testing those ideas and finding out what has to be true for those ideas to be really good ideas, engaged and a part of the process. So we wanted to lay out the different array of innovators that are in the room or should be in the room, we think. Also, we wanted to articulate just how fragile the environment is for innovation because 75% of the innovators that we laid out, right? 3 out of 4 of those different innovator profiles start out really anxious, nervous, and, you know, stressed out about the front end of design. And that is normal and typical and to be expected. So if 75% of the people beginning the process are going to have a hard time, you have to be really intentional and strategic about how you're going to create the environment for ideas to emerge. Otherwise, they're either going to bail out or they're going to get kicked off or they're just going to say, peace out, you know, I'm done.
Yeah.
This is too scratchy for me and I'm not creative. That's the worst outcome, right? Is someone says, this is uncomfortable, so I must not be creative and there's no place for me in innovation. And so we wanted to really lay that out. We also, I'm so glad that you liked the dialogue that we created.
Yeah, I thought that was just brilliant. It just made it very real. Right?
Yeah. And we wanted to model the conversations that we think could happen or might happen when you engage with these different array of innovators so that you have words to respond when you get pushback. And also just know, like, we've been there, done that. We've seen this. This is to be expected. It's no big deal. Here's the language you can use. Here are the tips that you can use to help get them back on track. It's going to be okay.
Yeah. And sometimes those comments in the room and they don't, you know, drivers don't do it because they're bad people. They're so, I mean, it's a great persona in so many different cases. But sometimes like those comments that they will literally just say out in the middle of the room really can just kind of completely knock the entire session off its axis, right? So having a toolkit and the prep that goes into those sessions too is equally important, but having a toolkit to be able to respond in the moment is so super important and get people back on track. Right. Not even those who are saying, hey, I shouldn't be here. I don't feel comfortable. I don't feel like I belong. I'm not creative and I'm not innovative. But even sort of in those cases where things can be derailed outside of that, even just by one comment.
Just introducing rules for engagement, like turn taking, so that the loudest person on the team or the loudest person in the room isn't dominating the conversation. So simple rules and simple tips to help get back on track.
I've been in a room where a driver said, where there was ideas on the wall and the driver literally said to like 20 people in a room, that idea will never work. Take it down. And everyone was like, oh my gosh, what just happened? You know, like it was the most awful thing.
Yeah.
Equally important in the book, you call it the destination.
Yeah.
And when I first saw that, I was like, okay, here's where you've got output, you know, you've got something you're doing different testing, even though you covered that in another part of the book. What I love about the destination is you have both personal and organizational development planning as the basis for the chapters in that kind of section. And you included, you and your co-author included evaluation models for both personal and organizational, which I think are so incredibly important. I don't know if a lot of organizations or individuals do enough of that, but how did you come up with those evaluation models? And what is your hope also for individuals to use them? I mean, do you see the organizational evaluation happening annually, semi-annually? Like, do you do it when you feel like the organization is at different inflection points? Like, tell us a little bit about those two models and maybe how to best put them into practice.
Yeah. So they came up. It was actually one of the last things that we did, because when we got to the end of the book, we're like, okay, the reader has just read all of this. And what do we want them to do? Right. So on a personal level, on an individual level, we felt like we owed it to the reader to put a plan in action. Mm. So that personal development plan is a really simple tool. We have a PDF version if your listeners and want to have a copy of it, but it's a really simple tool. It only includes a couple things, but it sets up the opportunity to move from your current state to a better state, to a better place. And it requires some self-reflection, some self-awareness about where I am now and where I want to go next. And then it gives you an opportunity to think about, you know, what are the projects in my job that might be able to help me do that? Who are the people that are experts in this that I may be able to talk to in my network or in my network's network? And like, what are the books I'm going to read? What are the videos that I might watch to help get better at that? So the PDP plan is really simple, but we feel like it gives you a plan of action to move forward. And you can fill one out for like each phase that we articulate. So you could put like six different PDP plans together, or just, you know, create one, just like work on one thing that you want to get better at. The assessment itself was really based on our MBCs. So all of those individual elements are the individual elements that are a part of the MBCs that we laid out in the rest of the book. So it took us the whole book to create the case for the science behind those MBCs and those behavior shifts that we think are really important, why they matter, what makes it really hard to do, so that we could let people know, that this is hard work. This is not easy stuff, right?
Not at all.
It's not easy stuff. But if you want to get better, these are the ways that you can do that. And then at the organizational level, we thought it was really important to help leaders understand where their organizations are, so that they can maybe bring the skills in that they need. We think there's a lot of power in understanding like how different teams and different departments evaluate themselves, because teams that are required to do testing or evaluate ideas that have no testing expertise could probably benefit from some new skills and some new talent. So,
and the organizational assessment too, right? It could almost act as a scorecard for how, as a business, you're evolving, applying design thinking more broadly, the impact that can have on your customers, on your employees, other stakeholders, whether that's partner vendors, whether that's investors, you know, whatever that is. So I really love that. Hey, look, I want to ask you one last question. You've got a busy day. Where do you get your inspiration from? I ask all guests that. I'm personally inspired by that question, always by the answers I get, but I'm curious to hear where you get your inspiration from.
Yeah, I get my inspiration from my students. So I teach, I'm a visiting professor at École des Ponts in Paris and Casablanca. And my students are from South America, Africa, India, Asia, Europe. They have extraordinary personal experiences. They live in extraordinary places. You know, colleagues, students from Syria who had to go into the war zone in order to attend class. You know, just incredible. So I'm very inspired by my students and their energy and youth. you know, I think it's important to surround yourself with young people. I have an 18-year-old daughter. So I really, I'm very intentional about surrounding myself with young people. Mm. I'm inspired by technology. You know, my dad took me to Frederick, Maryland, which is about an hour away from where I live, when the first, I'm dating myself here, but the first Lisa computer came out from Apple. And it was this really special occasion. And I felt like, you know, I was going to Mecca to go see, because it was the only Lisa in like a 200-mile radius or something.
Oh my gosh.
And so I am astounded by the creativity, the talent, the passion of technologists who create amazing technology. I just got finished working on a challenge around flying cars. Around this flying car challenge.
Yeah.
And I thought when we started this challenge that flying cars were going to be, you know, a decade or more off. And I'm now convinced that we will all be flying around in flying cars, you know, within the next 7 to 9 years, which is astounding to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm really one of the, I'm really inspired by technology as well. One of the things that I'm really trying to research and understand better is the metaverse's impact on customer experience and what that will mean. I know we're 10, 15 years off on that. Probably certainly you need 6G technology and other, you know, other things to really make that a reality for many or all, but I'm curious really to understand that more and what the impact might be. All right, Karen, this has been a great conversation. You can buy the book on Amazon. So you got one new reader outside of me. And I know a lot of people are buying the book. Experiencing Design, The Innovator's Journey. Fantastic book. Great examples to put into practice right away. Published by Columbia Business School, which is awesome. It's been just fun to get to know you and to have you on the show as well. Thanks so much for being on with us.
Thanks so much. It was a treat.
All right, everybody. Another great show. Karen Hold, author of Experience Design, The Innovator's Journey. We're out. We're out. Talk to you soon,
everyone.
Thanks
for listening to Be Customer Led with Bill Stakos. We are grateful to our audience for the gift of their time. Be sure to visit us at BeCustomerLed.com for more episodes. Leave us feedback on how we're doing or tell us what you want to hear more about. Until next time, we're out.